We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This year, this program, Focus, turned 30, and we've been marking the anniversary by bringing back some of the oldest programs that we have in our tape collection. And these are programs that, in most cases, haven't been heard in many years and touch on topics that we think are as important today as they were when we first had these conversations. Now, in this installment of what we are calling the Deep Archives Project, you will hear edited portions of two conversations with well-known writers on matters of faith, Houston Smith and Rabbi Harold Kushner. Houston Smith is the author of The World's Religions. It is a very widely read survey text of comparative religion. It was originally published in 1958, and at that time the title was The Religions of Man. To date, this book has sold over 2.5 million copies. And when we talked with Houston Smith in November of 1994, at that time he had just published a book, The Illustrated World's Religions, which essentially was the text of the earlier book, but also included many photographs and also many examples of religious artwork. And I began that conversation by asking Houston Smith whether he thought it was possible to separate divinely inspired truth from the very human institutions in which it sometimes resides.
After writing what was first The Religions of Man and then changed to Inclusive Gender to The World's Religion, that book considers each of the major enduring traditions in their integrity and individuality. But having done that, I wrote another book which in effect comes out of the commonalities that had surfaced as I was writing the first one. So this second book, Forgotten Truth, lists out the commonalities. Now, the interesting thing is that because I wrote that book on the commonalities, a friend of mine in religious studies, told me a few years ago, he said, you know, the scuttlebutt may not get to your ears, but in the religious studies, the word is going around that Houston Smith has this optical defect. He sees similarities everywhere. Mm-hmm. Well, in a way that's true, but what my friend went on to say is what they overlook is that you have actually written in the course of your career more about the differences between religions in East Asia, in South Asia, in the West, than you have about the similarities. But the truth of the matter, it's like theme and variation. Mm-hmm. There are common themes, and there are variations on these themes, and both are important, and both are very interesting.
Mm. Something that seems to me to emerge as a difference when one compares the East Asian traditions, I would include the Hindu faith, and I don't know whether you consider India East Asia, but at any rate.
No, I would consider, if I could just take a moment, I think if we're looking to the differences, there are four great families of religion.
Mm-hmm.
The original one, and it still continues, is the tribal and the oral, many of whom have no written text, but they have their myths that were handed down from their forefathers, which serve the same purpose. There's that tribal group, and then second there is among the rest are historical religions, which have written texts and change over the centuries, cumulative tradition, and there are three. Our Western group of the Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all of whom looked to Abraham as their historical founder. And then there's the South Asian family of basically Hinduism and Buddhism, India and Sri Lanka. And then there's the East Asian family, China, Japan, Korea, parts of Southeast Asia, which includes Confucianism, Taoism, East Asian Buddhism, Shinto, and the like.
Mm-hmm. Well, given now, I appreciate that having that sort of more clear delineation. And then maybe let me try to, again, make the same observation and see if you think that it is true. And I guess here the distinction I'm thinking of is something of a comparison between the historical traditions, that is, the religions of the book,
yeah,
Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and the Asian traditions. And it seems to me that there is...
I missed a word. What's the alternative to the people of the book?
Both of the Asian traditions that mentioned.
Yes, yes.
And perhaps grouping them together may be too much, but it... To me, it seems that one major difference is that it lies in where these faiths place the deity, in the sense that the historical traditions seem to have this tendency to place it outside of the individual, and the traditions of Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism seem more to want to place it within the individual.
This is a very common perception, excuse me, and there's something to it. There is something to it. Let me first indicate what is right about that, and then indicate a certain danger, what we overlook, mm-hmm, if we stop there. Beginning where you did, before one divides the historical religions, and I'm using that, defining it not only as the people of the book, but the people that have sacred texts, you know, like the Bhagavad Gita and the Tao Te Ching in China. But I divided those into three families, the Western, the South Asian, and the East Asian. But one can also significantly lump those South Asian and East Asian together up to a point. And when we make the split there, we can call it the Western religions and the Eastern religions, using that standard terminology today. It is true that the Western religions proceed in a kind of relational or dualistic manner, in that the God and the human self are clearly separated, and religion works mainly on their relationship. Mm-hmm. Now, how to get them into the best working relationship. Now, when we go over to the Eastern religions, and for the moment we're including both India and China in this, it is true that they have a more mystical, an openness to the mystical unity of life, wherein, as you correctly said, the deity is perceived not so much as over against or out there, but within. Now, so far, so good, and the way you pose the question is exactly right. I say exactly right. I want to take that back. It's right up to a point.
Okay.
But the deeper truth, and now we're coming to the commonalities that underline religions, is everywhere one finds people whose outlook is... you might say relational or dualistic. They are most occupied by relationships that can form between souls, individuals, things that are distinct, whereas other people are more inclined to sense the underlying in terms of which these dualities are secondary. And one finds, if we call them dualists and monists, one finds both kinds everywhere. But the original way you put it is right, is that the West has been proportionately more in the dualistic mode, and the Eastern religions have allowed a larger place for the monistic point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just add one thing, but you, it reaffirms the fact that you found both types in everywhere, because in India, perhaps the most mystical of the three families of religions, even there, numerically speaking, the dualists outnumber the monists. Ramakrishna, who played both sides of the street because he was a great saint of the 19th century and a religious virtuoso, but when he would get into his dualistic mode, why, he said, I want to eat sugar. I don't want to be sugar. It's the relationship which provides the context for the glory of the religious possibility in the dualistic way of approaching it.
Mm-hmm. It is, as you say, it is true that one finds both of these impulses or inclinations both in the Eastern and the Western traditions. And while one can say that within the Western traditions there always has been a kind of mystical corner,
yes.
I wonder if it's possible to say something about, though, why it is that, particularly within the Western traditions, that mystical impulse has never been terribly strong. It has never been really part of the mainstream.
That's a very, very good question. As a lifelong teacher, I always recognize a good question when I don't have a knee-jerk answer to it. It's really too good to get tied down. I could speculate on that, and I will. I'll just take a small venture into it, but I realize right off that I'm not going to really give an adequate answer, because I don't know that there we have a really adequate answer. But let me take a run at it. Of the three traditions, I'm now talking about what I'm calling the historical. They have written language, enduring major cities, and their traditions change over time. The Christianity of the Middle Ages isn't exactly the Christianity of the primitive church, and so on. If we take the family of historical religions, and as I say, there are three basic families, the Eastern, East Asian, South Asian, and the West. The West is the only one that developed in a temperate climate. In China, it was in the north where it was very cold. In India, it was south, humid, tropical. And each of these puts nature in a kind of unfriendly stance for a good part of the time. But the Western family originated on the eastern shores of the Mediterranean, where nature was in an unusually favorable mode. And this may have coaxed out from the people there a kind of more affirmative attitude towards nature than in the other two. It's the only family, for example, that sees the physical universe as the intentional creation of a being that is both all-powerful and all-good. and this gives his, her, its creation or handiwork a kind of dignity about it. It's meaningful, causing people to look towards it. Now, what I'm leading up to is not the obvious fact that modern science comes out of this more involved focus on nature than in the other two traditions. But what I'm saying is that when you talk about oneself and the world, while you're in a dual relationship, or you're in a relationship, you have oneself, and then you have what's out there. And what I'm speculating, but it's no more than that, is that this dualistic format or outlook on life, which was encouraged by a very sustained preoccupation with the natural world, may have eased over and influenced the theology, so that the subject, the human soul, and the object, the divine God, takes shape and establishes its position in a kind of dual relationship. Now, let me just wind this up by contrasting it with India. Whereas modern science arose in the West, and the West have are recognized by historians of religions as, in a way, the most materialistic of the historical religions. Just note one thing, their doctrine of the resurrection of the body. You don't have that in the other two, so that the physical has dignity even beyond death. They will not let the physical go. Now, by contrast, in India, the natural world is Maya. It has a certain reality, but it's a qualified reality, a provisional reality. They call it, coming back to the word Maya. Now, when you look upon the world as not altogether real, then the reality is within, and that is what transcends Maya. So introspectively, looking in is where India tends to find the divine, and of course, it's now quite generally known that their culminating statement is that Atman, or the deepest element within us, is Brahman, is God. So it encourages the approach to the divine as buried within and the deepest element within oneself.
We have several callers to talk with, and we will start in now with a caller on line number 4 in Eureka. Hello.
Hi, Dr. Smith.
Good morning.
Chomsky has analyzed the similarity of human languages.
He was my colleague at MIT for 15 years. I hold him in high regard.
In terms of an underlying structural uniformity in the human brain or mind.
Grammar.
Pardon me?
Deep grammar, grammatical structure. Mm-hmm. Yes, go ahead.
How would you answer someone who would make the claim that granted similarities in human religions, that not only could those similarities be ascribed to a similar underlying human mental uniformity, but also that there would be even more cause for such similarities because of the needs and wants and cravings of human minds, which would not contribute nearly so much to the mere structure of language and so forth.
Right. Yes, I think and I have often used Chomsky's model of the deep structure within the human mind as an analog in religion. Just to be concrete, if we look at it on the subjective side, there is this tropism, you might say, this outreach, this urge for more in the way of meaning, more in the way of significance than our daily life usually brings to view. You find that everywhere in the human makeup. Anthropologists have found no societies without religion, and this is the deepest region that brings it into being. But that's the subjective side. They all see in ways the same things, but only at a different level of abstraction. They all say that there is more integration, unity in the ultimate nature of things. Hear, O the Lord thy God, the Lord. Hear, O Israel, the Lord thy God, the Lord is one. They all have this notion of a unity, integration, which is more emphatic than our world of chaos and so on makes plain. Second, they all say that it is better. Reality, ultimate reality, is better than our normal experiences and everyday encounters discern. And finally, they all say it is vastly more mysterious than we usually take it to be. So there are these commonalities, I'm insisting, but the differences are also there, and both are important.
We're down to the point where we have just about 2 or 3 minutes left. I wish that we had more time. I'm sorry that we'll have to stop. There is one question, Professor Smith, I would like to ask, and maybe you could talk for a couple of minutes on.
All right.
The major religions that we have today have been around now for some time, although I suppose by historical standards they've not been around that long if you look at all of human history. But having said that, at least some thousands of years,
Yes. These
when they came along, obviously they must have supplanted religions that came before them.
Right.
Why is it that these major faiths that you write about, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, why do you think that they have survived and indeed have grown, and that nothing else has come along to supplant them?
Well, if I start with your last thing, nothing has come along to supplant them. If you have a copy of my current newest book, The Illustrated Religions, before you, as I do, the subtitle is A Guide to Our Wisdom Tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And more that phrase, our wisdom tradition, has come to the fore as I think about these enduring religious traditions. Now, not everything in them is wise. Their view of the physical universe has been superseded by modern science. And their social relationships, the patterns of gender relationships, master-slave and that, they pretty much picked up from their cultures at the time, and we live in a different world, and so those have to be reviewed. But when it comes to the nature of ultimate reality and how the human self can best comport itself within that reality, I see nothing that not only supersedes them, but even rivals their wisdom. Let me ask that, unfortunately, our general knowledge of these traditions is at a third grade level. I have steeped my years in plumbing these and am more and more impressed with the magnitude, the richness of them. Now, you have another part. Why did they supersede the oral tribal religions that preceded them? And the basic reason is that people started living in cities and they started relating to people outside their own primary face-to-face group, and therefore ethics had to come into the picture. The primal religions do not emphasize ethics because they are more or less like in large families, extended families, then it's not so important. But when you start dealing with people that are not in your primary group, ethics is very important, and that's the first and important thing that they build into the religious scene.
Well, it makes it sound as if, and I'm not sure this is what you were saying, but the implication seems to be that one reason that these religions took hold was that they were for these societies instruments of social order. That is, they helped keep the peace.
Yes, I would not say that the reason they took hold, because I think we're religious creatures, and religion is a factor in all society. I would say the new element that they introduced beyond the religious forms out of which they grew was the golden rule, and, you know, your feasts and sacrifice are an abomination to me, but let justice roll down like waters. That emphasis is what they introduced at that time, and you're quite right, because society needs that injection of exhortation towards the love of neighbor.
That is Houston Smith. He was a guest on the show. We called it Focus 580 then, in November of 1994. Now, at the age of 92, Houston Smith continues to write about religion. He has many books in print. You can find out more about him and his work by going to his website that is houstonsmith.net. This is Focus. This year our program turned 30, and to celebrate, we're digging into our tape collection, looking for interesting people with things to say about important subjects. These are programs that are not part of our web archive and in most cases have not been heard since they were first broadcast. We're calling it the Deep Archives Project, and we'll have more after a short break. This is Focus.
For 20 years, FBI agent Bob Whitman chased art thieves and recovered stolen treasure. He met criminals in hotel rooms with a suitcase of cash, hoping the SWAT team next door could get there in time if his cover was blown. On the next Fresh Air, Whitman talks about his memoir, Priceless, and we hear from actor Javier Bardem. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. You can find out what we're doing all throughout the week, next week, by going to our website. In fact, that way you can listen to past programs you may have missed the first time around. That's WILL.illinois.edu. On Monday, I'll be talking with Joshua Kendall, a journalist and author of a new biography of Noah Webster and the role that he played in American history. Celeste Quinn will host the second hour. Her guest, Cindy Laverty, a caregiver expert and author, and they will talk about her book, Caregiving, Elder Care Made Clear and Simple. Then Tuesday, 10 o'clock, the guest is Michael Gratz. He is professor of law at Yale University. We'll talk about his book, The End of Energy, The Unmaking of America's Environment, Security, and Independence. That's just a few of the things we have for next week. And once again, you can check on the schedule by going to the website, will.illinois.edu. This is Focus. It's our morning talk show. This year, the show turned 30, and as a part of the celebration, we are rebroadcasting some of the oldest programs we have, programs that feature interesting guests, we think, and certainly they're shows that haven't been heard in a long time. In part two of today's program, we have a conversation with Rabbi Harold Kushner, best known probably for his book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. That was published in 1981. When we talked in the November of 1996, he just published a book titled, How Good Do We Have to Be? That book acknowledges that, while we say nobody is perfect, a lot of human misery can be traced to our expectations of perfection in ourselves and others. In the book, Rabbi Kushner argues that we humans are all prone to make mistakes, and we would all be better off if we could be a little bit more forgiving. We begin our conversation by talking about that bedrock story of human failure, the biblical account of the fall.
David, I think the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden is the single most misunderstood story in all of Western literature. We read it as a fall. We read it as the original sin that got us all in trouble, about how people made one mistake and were punished forever, and we're still suffering the consequences of that mistake. And the more I talk to people about it, the more I find that lots of people out there have had the same problem with the story that I've had for most of my life, and they thought they were the only ones. And they thought they weren't supposed to feel that way. But it just doesn't make sense for God to punish people so severely for one violation, and especially if the violation is acquiring a knowledge of good and evil. Even as a child, I had this notion that having a knowledge of good and evil is a good thing and not a sin. So I could never quite understand the story. I don't think it's the story of paradise lost. I think it's the story of paradise outgrown. I would say that the story of the Garden of Eden is the biblical account of evolution, how the first human ancestors transcended the level of living like animals or living in the innocence of children, entered the world of a knowledge of good and evil. And at that point, the moral decisions and judgments we have to make every single day, as parents, as children, as spouses, as business people, as neighbors, are so complicated in a way that no other animal could understand. Nobody's going to be perfect at it any more than a good baseball player will hit 1,000 and get a hit every time up. I can't believe God asks us to do the impossible.
It begins to look like entrapment. One wonders just what's the motivation of God here to do this, to set these people up and to say, as the story does, here, everything is for you, it's all for you, but for this one thing, don't do this one thing. And it begins to indeed to look like an invitation to break the rule. And one wonders just what that was all about.
I know, it really doesn't make God look very good in that story. The traditional interpretation that I was given as a child is that in order to let Adam and Eve be moral, God had to give them one rule to obey, and he made it very easy for them. But that presumes that before the incident in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve had a knowledge of what good and evil are about, in which case, what is the fruit for? The only way the story makes sense is to assume that Adam and Eve had no conscience, had no sense of morality before they eat the fruit, and only afterwards do they realize that life is so complicated that they are capable of doing things which are morally wrong. Only by eating the fruit do they acquire a conscience. And that raises the question, how could God have expected them to be law-abiding when they had no sense of what it meant to be law-abiding?
And it's your feeling that this notion that I take to be a Christian notion, and I'm not sure whether that idea, would you find the idea in Judaism, that is the idea of original sin,
yes,
is somehow so firmly ingrained in us that it leads us to have this lingering doubt that no matter what we do, we're doomed, and that we'll not only is one never really good enough for God, but that means we're never good enough for our parents, our children are never good enough for us. I mean, maybe we're never even good enough for ourselves.
Oh, especially for ourselves. I think we're harder. Some people are harder on themselves. I find there are two kinds of people that I run into. Those who expect other people to be perfect and are unforgiving of them, and those who expect themselves to be perfect and are unforgiving of themselves. David, I'm really not sure what this stems from. Sometimes I think we are hardwired to conceive of perfection as the goal, and we're just sort of almost genetically programmed to feel bad about ourselves when we can't be perfect. And sometimes I think it's something we have gotten from a distortion of religion. The notion of original sin is not biblical in the sense that it is found nowhere in the Hebrew Scriptures. The Bible never talks about what happened in the Garden of Eden as a sin, and it really, except in a few very ambivalent verses, never says that human beings are inevitably depraved. On the contrary, the vision of humanity that I get from the Hebrew Scriptures is that human beings are capable of goodness, capable of great evil, but neither one is inevitable. What you find prominently in classical Christianity and to a lesser degree in post-biblical Judaism is this notion that Adam and Eve could have been a model of perfect humanity and spoiled it by disobeying God. Elaine Pagels, you alluded to her book, Adam, Eve, and the Serpent. She has a wonderful answer there. It's not really about the Garden of Eden. It's about the Christian notion of original sin. And Ms. Pagels' answer is, some people would rather feel guilty than feel helpless. That is, if you say, it's all my fault, that's both a way of putting yourself down and simultaneously a way of claiming great power for yourself. To say, it rained on Sunday because I was planning a picnic, is to blame yourself for the bad weather, but also to arrogate to yourself the power to control the weather. to say it's my fault that the child died, I should have been more attentive, is to flagellate yourself with guilt, but also to say, I am so powerful, I control issues of who shall live and who shall die. I am almost like God in that regard. And I think Pagels is really onto something. There is something ego-enhancing, even as there is something punishing and diminishing when a person says, I am guilty, this was all my fault.
Our guest this morning is Harold Kushner. He is a rabbi. He is the author of a number of books. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, I think perhaps the one that people will know or perhaps will have seen or have heard of is his book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. He has a new book out that's recently been published. The title of that book is How Good Do We Have to Be? And it's published by Little Brown, is out now. And we welcome questions, comments, people who want to join in the conversation. We have someone we'll get right to.
Good morning. I'm interested in what further things you have to say about forgiveness, especially self-forgiveness, and I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, that's a very straightforward question and a very profound one. Let me say, first of all, that feeling guilty is not a message that you're a bad person. If you were a bad person, you wouldn't feel guilty even if you'd done something wrong. Feeling guilty gives you the message that you're a good person who hasn't been as good as you feel you should be. I like to use the distinction that a lot of psychologists use between guilt and shame. Guilt is feeling bad for something you've done, and shame is feeling bad for who you are. So if your problem is guilt, forgiving yourself for bad deeds, I found a very useful thing is just do good deeds. Do something nice for somebody. Be charitable. Go out of your way to do somebody a favor. Compliment someone. And that enables you to say to yourself, sometimes I am thoughtless and selfish, but sometimes I'm very kind and generous, and I choose to say that's the real me. If you've got a mild case of guilt, that's sometimes all you need to forgive yourself. If it goes deeper than that, you need one or more people whom you respect to tell you that you're a good person. A spouse, a parent, a teacher, a clergy person, an athletic coach, somebody you respect, or if it's really a bad case, this is where support groups, 12-step programs can be very, very helpful. People who will say to you, we know the demons you are wrestling with. We know all the things that make you ashamed of yourself. We wrestle with them too, and we don't let them control us. We don't let them define who we are, and you should do the same thing. Define yourself by your best and not by your weakest.
Let's go on. We'll talk with another call. This is Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Good morning. I have a question that's a continuation of your discussion on forgiveness, but in this case, I'm asking for a little more discussion on the importance or the way to forgive someone who's done you a great wrong. I have as an example a friend of mine who had a very emotionally abusive relationship with his parents, and he's currently estranged from these from his parents, and is struggling with the idea of what relationship he should have with them. The parents on this hand have not acknowledged any responsibility on their part. They've never asked for forgiveness. In fact, they probably think they have done nothing wrong.
I'm sure.
But they have caused my friend a great deal of emotional turmoil. How would you suggest that he deal with the concept of forgiveness, knowing that in some way forgiveness is as much for yourself in dealing with it as it is to provide the generosity of forgiveness to the offender?
Uh-huh.
I think part of his concern is that by offering forgiveness to someone who has not even acknowledged a wrong, that he is in some way saying it was okay what was done to him. So I'll hang up now and listen to your suggestion.
You've given the answer. Let me just rephrase it. The first step, I think, is to realize that forgiveness is a favor you do yourself, not a favor you do the other person. And the second is to realize that forgiveness does not have to mean condoning, excusing, or approving of what the other person did. Forgiveness, as I understand it, is a way of saying what you did was mean and thoughtless and very unkind, but you do not have the power to live inside my head and mess up my thoughts. Forgiveness means I deny you the power to define me as a bad person, to define me as a victim. And as long as I am obsessed with what you did to me, I will continue to think of myself as a victim. Forgiveness in your friend's case would definitely not mean saying, I was wrong, my parents were right, what my parents did was understandable. No, I would never ask him to say that. That would violate his own integrity. Forgiveness would mean saying, my parents did some very hurtful things because they are limited people. When I was a child, I couldn't understand that. Now that I have grown up, I understand that they did a lot of very thoughtless things and they were wrong. And I refuse to go on thinking of myself as a victim. I refuse to think of myself in the terms by which they defined me. I liberate myself from their power over me, and at that point, I no longer have to be as emotionally enmeshed with them. I can forgive them for being human. I can forgive them for being limited. I can forgive them for being mean and selfish and narcissistic. Once I realize that I don't have to see myself the way they taught me to see myself. Forgiveness in that case can go, not excusing, not approving, not saying it was okay, but rather saying it was really very bad, and I refuse to become obsessed with it because the longer I'm obsessed with it, the more I think of myself in ways I don't like to.
All right. I hope that, again, it gets to the caller's concern. I think that some people might argue that one of the benefits of religion, at least as far as civil society is concerned, and maybe to individuals as well, and it's probably true of any religion, is that it says one ought to live as if at some point you will be called to account for the way that you have lived.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say that everything you do has consequences, and that someday, you know, I suppose that people will think of the image of St. Peter at the gate, but that as if, or choose whatever tradition you want, as if someday someone's going to sit down across from you and say, okay, let's look at how you've lived. You know, given the fact that that kind of taking stock is good, and it's to do it not just at the end of your life, but and maybe all the way along, kind of ask yourself that. How do you, and considering the fact that perfection is not possible and we want to perhaps expect a lot of ourselves and yet do that in a realistic way, how really does one do that? I mean, I guess, again, we're going back to this question of striking some balance between the people, being the people that we want to be, perhaps feel that we should be, and the people that we are capable of being.
Yeah, I think, by the way, I totally agree that people need this sense that they will be judged, not because we look forward to the verdict, but because that's the only way we feel that we are taken seriously as moral creatures. It's a little bit like if you can remember being in college and handing in a paper that you were really proud of, you'd worked hard at it, and getting it back 2 days later with a check mark next to your name, and you realize the professor never bothered to read it. And you felt, what's the point of knocking myself out to do it well if nobody's going to make the difference? I think we want to get the message that our moral choices, our behavior, is taken seriously at the highest level. But at the same time, I think we need the reassurance that when we have tried and done our best, or when we have been guilty of occasional lapses which embarrass us, that won't be held excessively against us. That, on the one hand, a person who murders one person is considered a murderer and can't exonerate himself by pointing to all the people he didn't kill. Some people would say a person who violates one moral law is a sinner, and you don't lose that label by pointing to all the sins you didn't commit. And that's what I'm rejecting. That's what I'm saying is it's an unrealistic standard. No, the ideal I would like to have is that we will be held to account. All our decisions will be taken seriously, but they'll be taken seriously in the context of our being human beings, and that the choices human beings have to make are so complex. The decisions we had to make raising our children, there's this beautiful passage in my book that I quote from Marion Wright Edelman, where she apologizes to her children for all the mistakes she made as a parent. Times when she scolded when she should have delighted, times when she talked when she should have listened, times when she said no that she should have said yes. We all make mistakes like that. We all try to be good parents and find that being a good parent is a lot harder than being good at our jobs. And we feel terrible for that. I would like to know that when I am judged as a parent, in whatever form that metaphor turns out to take, I will be judged by the sincerity and integrity of my efforts and not by the perfection of the results. You know, if I'm a doctor performing an operation, if I'm an engineer building a bridge, I can't afford to make one mistake. If I'm a parent raising a child, please don't tell me that I can't afford to make one mistake, because that'll just mess me up forever. There's no way I can raise that child without ever making a mistake.
We began talking a little bit about Genesis, and I want to at least try to hear for a minute or two to return to that, because I'm very interested in another point that you make in the book about how we have talked about that event, the creation of man, creation of woman. The way that the creation of woman story is generally told is that
Eve is an afterthought.
That's right, and that God was saying, "Well, I got to make a mate for Adam here," and so he pulls from Adam a rib, and from that bone comes Eve. And you say that in fact there's another way to read that that would perhaps make you think differently about it, and that in fact what God did was not just, he didn't just pull this one little part. What he actually did was split Adam. That is, he took what was one creature and from that split two, which then, you know, gets us again to thinking about what it is that when two people come together, what it is they're doing, that they're, in a sense, trying to complete themselves.
David, I'm so glad you brought that up. That is probably my favorite section of the whole book, and I am absolutely convinced that I'm right about this. I'm absolutely convinced this is what Scripture is trying to say. The Hebrew word, which is translated rib, three times more often in biblical Hebrew does not mean rib, it means side. And I think what you have in that opening chapter of Scripture, the story of the creation of Adam and Eve, is the equivalent of a myth that some of your readers will remember from Plato's Symposium, and that I've also found in Native American and in Hindu scriptures. The first human being was sort of Siamese twins, an androgynous creature, one side male and one side female, which I think is what the Bible meant when it said male and female, God created them. When God could not find a suitable mate for this androgynous creature, he put it to sleep, cut it in half, took one side, not rib, the Hebrew word means side, took one side away from the other, closed up the incision. And that's why Adam says, this is flesh of my flesh and bone of my bone, and that's why the Bible says a man leaves his parents, cleaves unto his wife, and they become one. The implications of reading side rather than rib are momentous. It means Eve is not an afterthought. It means Eve is there, coterminous with Adam from the beginning. She hears the command. It's not passed on to her by her husband. And it means that when a man and woman join, when they marry, they're not simply looking for legal and sexual union or a way to reproduce. They're looking for wholeness. Hmm. They're trying to regain a sense of completeness that at some genetic level we understand we had at the beginning. They are trying to create something new, not two individuals sleeping together, but one individual creature made up of one man and one woman. It is an overpoweringly important definition of marriage. It is a liberating statement for women to see the Bible as a book that takes them as seriously as it takes men. And I really think this was the original meaning of Scripture.
That's Harold Kushner. He was a guest on our program. Back then we called it Focus 580 in November of 1996. We were talking about a book that was new at that time, the book How Good Do We Have to Be? He's the author of several others, including the bestseller When Bad Things Happen to Good People. This year, this show, Focus, then we called it Focus 580 when we started out. The program is 30 years old, and we're celebrating that fact by digging into our tape collection, looking for interviews with remarkable people who have things to say about important subjects. These are programs that are not part of our web archive, and a lot of these shows haven't been heard since they were first broadcasted. We are calling it the Deep Archives Project. We'd like to know what you think. You can tell us what you think about these shows, or in fact anything else we do, by going to the Focus section of our webpage. Near the top, you will find a place that you can leave a comment. You can also write to us, if you'd like to do it that way, to WILL at 300 North Goodwin in Urbana, Illinois, and the zip is 61801.